Thank you. Welcome, everyone. I will call the Joint Committee on Implementing Measure 91 to order. We have on our agenda tonight, we have posted for a work session Senate Bill 844, and that was for the purposes of getting an update from the OLCC and a discussion with committee members on reaction to our testimony last week. But before we do that, we are going to have a public hearing on two bills, Senate Bill 445 and Senate Bill 464. So we will start out by opening a and also I should explain my honorable co-chair, who is always punctual, is stuck in another committee, as is Representative Olson. So we will now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 445. Adam.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 445A comes from the Senate Committee on Human Services and Early Childhood. It requires a registered medical marijuana facility and licensed marijuana retailer to post notice of harmful potential effects of marijuana on pregnant women, potential harmful effects of marijuana on breastfeeding infants, and potential of marijuana to cause birth defects. It directs a notice to be visible to any individual receiving marijuana or usable marijuana. It directs the Oregon Health Authority to adopt by rule the contents of a notice for medical marijuana facilities, directs the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to adopt by rule contents of a notice for marijuana retailers. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
And we are joined by the extremely busy Senator Manas Anderson, who's had a long day.
That's a very long day. Thank you, Madam
Chair. So welcome to the committee.
And members of the committee, I'm Lori Manas Anderson, State Senator from Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and parts of East Portland. I'm a public health nurse, and so I'm really into prevention. I bring you Senate Bill 445, which will require medical marijuana facilities and marijuana retailers to post on the premises a notice of the potential harmful effects of marijuana on pregnant women, fetuses, and breastfeeding infants. I know there needs to be a lot more research on marijuana. We just don't have good quality research yet. But according to the Communicable Disease Summary News in 2014, marijuana can have adverse effects on development. Use during pregnancy has been linked to low birth weight, preterm labor, higher neonatal intensive care admissions, and developmental delays. Marijuana use can have an effect on the developing brains of infants and children, and THC concentrates in breast milk and may produce sedation, reduced muscular tone, and poor sucking in infants. Again, I'll say more research needs to happen, but from a public health perspective, we really need to warn users of marijuana of the possible harmful effects in the control of brain maturation and emotional responses. I remember for years we didn't do this with alcohol, and we had so many fetal alcohol syndrome babies until finally they saw the link. I would rather be proactive in preventing this from happening in our future generation babies. More research is needed also because we have to disentangle the marijuana-specific effects from environmental factors, maternal nutrition, exposure to nurturing neglect, and use of other substances by mothers. So establishing marijuana's effect on prenatal development is important because roughly half of the U.S. pregnancies are unplanned, with a rate considerably higher for teen and young adults. So many women may use marijuana without even knowing they're pregnant. It's really a common sense bill, and I do urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? No questions? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Senator. I'm wondering, with the idea of having OLCC adopt the rules and the contents, would you be open to the idea that perhaps Oregon Health Authority might be the better entity to actually come up with the language and to present to OLCC?
Right, and I think that's how the the 445A. Are you looking
at 445A? Thank you very much. I'm just looking at the original bill.
Yeah, no. We amended it in my committee, and the A's reflect that very request.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Our next witness is Ann Euler.
My name is Ann Uhler. I'm a board member of the Women's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Issues. Appreciate Senator Burdick and Senator and Representative Leninger, who cannot be here, for allowing this hearing to happen. I'm going to make this brief because you have and should have in front of you or have had my testimony, and I just wanted to quickly summarize for you so that we can you can get on with this late evening meeting. The Women's Commission supports House or Senate Bill 445 based on the research from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which shows that marijuana can be harmful to the pregnant woman. It increases their chance of having more lung infections. It increases their chance of having more heart attacks. And it, of course, impairs judgment and motor coordination during after partaking. The other reason that we support it, based on this research, and you can go and look at the research, is that the risk to the child can be twofold. One is that the brain development can be and the behavior of the child can be negatively affected by the marijuana. We also support it because when pregnant women who also have other mental health problems can worsen their course of their illness. And finally, as a commission, we're always looking at the cost, and you can count on the more pregnant women that use marijuana will increase their health costs for the very reasons that I just talked about. And so we're not anxious to increase health costs and social service costs as a result of this bill. So I want to say thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? No, they're not. Thank you very much. Our next witnesses will be in a panel of opposition, Lindsay Reinhart, Jess McKinney, and Aaron Purchase. Welcome. Who would like to go first?
Good evening, members of the committee. My name is Lindsay Reinhart. I submitted six pieces of evidence to you this afternoon in regards to Senate Bill 464. I reside in Happy Valley, Oregon. In 445, I apologize. One of the pieces that I introduced to you was a letter from the Director of Legal Advocacy from the National Advocates for Pregnant Women. And in her letter, she outlines several strong statements in her disagreement with this bill and its needs for pregnant women to be warned about a non-toxic plant. And so she has her statement there for your review. Also, Lynn Petreau of the same organization is the executive's director and concluded in her statement that women who report use of illicit drugs during pregnancy differ in demographic and socioeconomic backgrounds from non-users. Reported cannabis use does not seem to be associated with low birth weight or preterm birth. Both of their statements were supported by more evidence that I submitted as well in the form of affidavits from several cases. One was from Dr. Carl Hart, who is sworn in as a psychologist and a neurologist with specialized training in neuropsychopharmacology and substance abuse. He has stated in here that it is not harmful to infants, children, or nursing babies. In fact, I would further his statement personally by saying that we all have an endocannabinoid system, and mothers naturally produce endocannabinoids and send them to their infants through the breast milk ducts. Also, unsighted harmful effects were just listed here, but I did not hear any proper citation other than government-funded studies when there are several pieces that I have submitted to you that are several of the pages are actual citing studies that reference the work. Also, Dr. Freed is another PhD in psychology, and he is a tenured professor as well, and he is sworn in on a case stating that cannabis use is not harmful to infants in utero. And finally, a Dr. Deborah Frank, also sworn in with a Harvard Medical School degree in pediatrics and developmental behavioral pediatrics, is sworn in saying that it's not harmful to the fetus or developing brain. There are more studies available. I know that it's very popular to say that marijuana is understudied, but the substance has been around for 5,000 years, and 20 years of studies are published in medical journals, several of which are cited in the documents that I submitted to you. So I would really encourage you to also look at Colorado, where they tried this there too, and it did not work because the scientific statements were not there. So I would urge you to please act out of science and not fear, and go ahead and research the material that I presented to you today so that you can have a better understanding of the non-toxicology of this plant. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take all the witnesses and then open it up for questions.
Good evening. My name is Jessica McKinney, and I wanted to thank you for allowing me to talk to you today. I just wanted to share my personal story with you regarding cannabis and my use during one of my pregnancies. So when I was pregnant with my daughter Morgan, I had a complete placenta previa. The condition required me to be on bed rest for my entire pregnancy. I had to have my feet up as pressure on the cervix would cause the placenta to rupture and bleed, and it would cause hemorrhaging to myself and my fetus. I also had severe morning sickness, and at the end of my pregnancy, it resulted in a 40-pound weight loss. The constant vomiting would cause pressure on my cervix, which in turn would cause bleeding, and I was in the hospital numerous times. I used cannabis during my pregnancy, and I would do it again. It caused the morning sickness to lessen, and my weight loss was not as rapid. I am also a patient for severe muscle spasms and pain. I would not use a narcotic, nor was it recommended by my doctor to use it during my pregnancy. I am thankful for the opportunity that I had to use cannabis, especially in a state where it was allowed to be used, and I could be open about it. It allowed me to find relief and rest comfortably, which was the ultimate goal, my doctor told me. Upon birth, my daughter tested positive for marijuana at Mount Hood Medical Center in Gresham. I was interviewed by a social worker, and at that time, I was just complimented on the behavior of my children and my general parenting. I left the hospital, aside from my other complications, I left on time and with a very healthy baby girl. I attached, submitted to you guys online, a copy of her current report card. I would have given you more, but I just found out about this today, and I thought you might find it somewhat beneficial. So this is the best I could come up with on short notice. But Morgan is in third grade in the Gresham-Barlow School District. The Gresham-Barlow School District grades with end-of-the-year benchmarks in mind. So at parent-teacher conferences at the beginning of the year, the teacher explained to me that this can cause a false sense of failure on the report card, as no child can meet the end-of-the-year goals at the beginning of the year. It's expected that they're going to improve. So she told me she wasn't comfortable with giving Morgan exceeding or meeting marks, but she really felt that Morgan pretty much met her marks. So I would encourage you to look at Morgan's report card, which I'm very proud of, and so is she. At the end of the second trimester, which just was published, she met 19 out of 37 of the end-of-the-year goals, and she exceeded 18 out of 37. And she has always and consistently exceeded the benchmarks for what is listed on her report card as characteristics as a learner and a citizen. I do not believe that cannabis is harmful to a fetus. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here today. My name is Erin Purchase. I'm with Stony Girl Gardens. I am a patient advocate. I'm also a pediatric cannabis therapy advocate. I'm a grower patient caregiver for several OMMP patients, and I once managed a medical marijuana dispensary here in Portland. When I was pregnant 4 years ago was when I became a patient on the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. This was after I failed every single nausea medicine that the doctors had to offer, including a hospitalization with a drug that I had to sign a waiver for that said it could cause my kid brain damage. And it was a drug that was only for chemotherapy patients, and it was supposed to stop the nausea that I was puking 50 times for 32 weeks. I had not gained a single pound, and actually I have lost weight. I had HELLP syndrome. It's a form of toxemia, also an induced liver disease. I then got introduced to cannabis. And it was, I was like, wow, I'm pregnant. I'm not sure about this. But I smoked a few bowls. And for the first time, I was able to go like 4 hours without puking, which was amazing. I couldn't, for 32 weeks, I drove my kid to school and puked on the side of the road every morning. It was awful. So cannabis allowed me to no longer ever even have to take one of their anti-nausea pills that they were giving me. And it allowed me to gain 10 pounds in just 4 weeks before I had her. I have two daughters. I have a 4-year-old and a 9-year-old. My 4-year-old is the only child I used cannabis for when I was pregnant. My 9-year-old suffered acute lymphoblastic leukemia. In 2012, she was diagnosed. It is very hard. It is very sad to watch your kid be so sick. But the one thing that provided her relief was cannabis oil. 10 days after she was diagnosed, I got her on the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program, and I delivered her her first dose of cannabis oil. And yes, she got intoxicated. I give her an oil that is high in THC because that is what killed her cancer. She's cancer-free now. She was very sleepy, tired. She wanted to eat, and she was laughing.
Back off the mic a little bit. It's very sensitive.
She went through 2.5 years of an 8-drug combination where most kids end up with a feeding tube in her nose without even losing a single pound. She has just the same thing went on at conferences as she said. She exceeded almost everything except for there was a few where she got like B's, and they explained that with Common Core now, they don't look at the final grade until the end of the year. So even my kid that's taking cannabis every day for almost 3 years now is pulling straight A's. I personally do not feel at all that cannabis is harmful to pregnancies, to fetuses, to children, to infants, when the mother is sick or the child is sick. Granted, I'm not for recreational use in minor children. I submitted a document to you guys to go over today. I was here last week, and I had some concerns that came up. I don't have to go over that at this time because I know it's just for the Senate bill. I wanted to share my story with you guys. My daughter that I use cannabis for, she's almost 4 years old. She's doing fabulous, right where she should be, actually ahead of the curve. So she's as big as she should be. She's above the 50th percentile height, weight. She talks. She's healthy. She's great. So I really don't think that there's so much of a concern. And when you're puking your guts out and you can't stop, it's really, there's going to be people heading to the recreational stores 9 months pregnant and puking their guts out like I was. So
thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Ms. McKinney, can I just ask a little bit about your communication with your doctor when you decided that you would use cannabis during your pregnancy? Mm-hmm. Were there discussions with your doctor?
Yes, they were absolutely open to it.
Okay. I appreciate that answer.
You.
I was asking.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I apologize.
But if there were discussions to your doctor, did your doctor express concerns about, the pros and cons of cannabis use in pregnancy?
We had a discussion about it every time I went into the doctor. And I started off off my visits by telling her I am a medical patient to begin with. This is what I use. I don't want to go to a narcotic just because I'm pregnant. And she's like, yeah, that's ridiculous. But her only concern was that I felt comfortable with it. She says, if it makes you feel good, you listen to your body. And then carcinogens.
Gotcha.
That was it.
It may follow.
Please hold on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one last follow-up question, and all three of you would be open to answer this. Given that even your doctor talked with you about the possible pros and cons, having a notification that says may cause complications or may cause damage, what concern do you have about having that language in a facility, a marijuana facility, that says may? That it may cause complications.
I think my concern is not necessary. Is more with not really with the word, but it's more with the all-encompassing word of complications. I kind of feel that carcinogens are really the only issue. You don't know much about me, but I have been around cannabis quite a bit, and I'm very experienced in it. I've worked in the dispensaries. I've worked with labs and people, and I do see it help and affect children every day, pregnant women. My sister-in-law, she breastfeeds. She's open with her doctors about it in Wyoming. Her son, it meets all of his benchmarks. He's great, cognitive. I talk to him on the phone. He's like 6 months old. He's interactive.
Thank you very much.
I think it could potentially basically turn somebody away from an option that could help them. Because from my research, there's no proven anything. There's no medical studies proving that it affects the fetus and the pregnancy negatively.
Further, I'd like to add to that point that if you find yourself in a social situation, that might be a way for new litigation to occur if somebody is caught in a situation with CPS where it's stated that it may cause harmful side effects when there's no science to back up that research. We wouldn't want to find somebody in a precarious situation because language was worded not on science.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Coacher.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you very much. Hey, is there anybody else who would like to speak on Senate Bill 445? Okay, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 445 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 464. Adam.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 464 prohibits a medical marijuana cardholder from processing cannabinoid extracts unless the cardholder is certified with the Oregon Health Authority to do so after January 1st, 2016. It requires the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to work together to adopt rules regulating the processing of cannabinoid extracts. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you. And Senator Pruzanski, did you have some introductory comments?
Madam Co-Chair, Sam Chapman is going to be coming forward to give testimony. All I would say is I've said for the committee before, my concern in the areas of allowing for this type of process to be done in the way of extracts at home is the toxic taints that are very volatile in causing fires and explosions. I am supportive of the bill based on its interpretation and how we currently have the definitions in both the Senate Bill 936 as well as in House Bill 3400, denoting what a cannabinoid extract is and, more importantly, what it is not, that would allow for individuals at home to do it in what would be a more safe, controlled setting without using taints such as butane, propane.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Chapman, maybe you can come up and start us out here. Welcome.
Co-Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Sam Chapman. Thank you for having me testify today. I run a firm called New Economy Consulting that works with local governments and entrepreneurs navigating regulations throughout the industry. And before I kind of dive into the bill, I wanted to play a quick clip for you regarding extracts and how they are being made today.
Dangerous, highly flammable, and perfectly legal. We've seen hash oil explosions in local apartments, homes, hotels, even a gas station bathroom. But that could soon change. Lawmakers in Salem are trying to stop the growing and explosive problem.
Last year alone, at least 10 people in Oregon ended up at Legacy Emanuel's burn unit. And as Fox News' Marilyn Deutsch reports, it's not just those who are cooking the hash oil who are at risk.
In Oregon, one child did suffer broken bones after escaping a butane hash oil explosion. Mostly, though, it's the guys cooking up the stuff who get badly burned. Though in Gresham, one died. But it may just be a matter of time before an innocent bystander is killed in one of these explosions. It's already happened up north. Bellevue, Washington, November 2013. A hash oil explosion in this apartment complex forces residents in other apartments to jump for safety. One of them, an 87-year-old woman, dies. Explosions locally have happened in homes, apartments, hotel rooms, even this bathroom at a 76 station. Hash oil is a highly concentrated form of marijuana. Butane, a highly flammable gas, is used to heat the marijuana leaves. From that, you get a honey oil-like extract and a more potent high. It takes the tiniest of sparks to ignite butane vapors, even in well-ventilated areas. Hard to get better ventilation than outdoors. But this butane hash oil explosion happened outdoors in Kaiser.
And then, you see it burned, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And then the first one, of course.
Kaiser Deputy Police Chief Jeff Kuhn says even though no one was hurt in this explosion, it's a scary situation.
Butane.
Tori Riccardi was not the cook manufacturing the hash oil that caused that explosion in Kaiser, but one of his employees did do the manufacturing. Tori runs a business called Mountaintop that supplies hash oil to medical marijuana dispensaries. Tori demonstrates the process for us.
Basically, it's taking a can, sticking it in your top port. Okay. Now what that's going to do, you're going to sit here for a minute and you can watch it.
Tori says he's been cooking up hash oil for several years, and this was his company's first and only explosion. Tori agrees making butane hash oil can be dangerous and should be left to professionals. In fact, he's building himself an enclosed, spark-free system. In Oregon, many cooking up hash oil, like Tori, have medical marijuana cards. And despite the dangerous explosions, most have faced only minor charges. There is a kind of gray area in Oregon law when it comes to hash oil explosions. Oregon lawmakers are considering revising Oregon.
So the law that she's about to speak about here is actually a separate bill that is not being addressed today that Representative Olson, I believe, is sponsoring. But as you can see, there is grave concern for public safety in this area. The medical cannabis community is very much in need of this type of product, but they are not in need, in my opinion, of the way that it's currently being made. From there, Senate Bill 464 seeks to alleviate those concerns by empowering the OHA and the OLCC to develop rules to ensure the safety of its commercial production. As you may already be aware, Measure 91 made it illegal for people over the age of 21 and everyone to produce their own extracts at home, but was silent about the medical cannabis program creating extracts at home. This seeks to close that loophole. I would like to name a couple of things of what Senate Bill 464 does and then what it does not do. Senate Bill 464 ensures the safe production of marijuana extracts by empowering the OLCC and OHA to analyze the production process for marijuana extracts and with such knowledge create rules to ensure the future safety of that process. It also establishes clear criteria from which the OHA and OLCC can act by outlining 7 different criteria ranging from the hygiene of the producer to test the end product to ensure that the OHA and the OLCC has a clear guidance regarding its risk. Furthermore, by assigning this responsibility to the OLCC, Senate Bill 464 puts this responsibility in regulating the hands of regulators, ensuring that facts, not political rhetoric, will drive the creation of rules and regulations. And finally, it ensures that marijuana extracts produced are safe. What it does not do, which goes to Senator Poznanski's point regarding the need for medical patients to produce cannabis extracts at home for their own personal use, not for commercial, but for their own personal use. I believe that Senator Przanski pointed towards Senate Bill 936, which has very similar language to Senate Bill 464. The one difference between the two is that 464 actually leaves out one slight piece of language that I see here in 936, in that what the cannabinoid extract does not include. And in 936, that says it does not include a product containing cannabinoids that have been separated from marijuana by a mechanical process, b, a product containing cannabinoids that have been separated from marijuana using glycerin, fats, oils, or waters that could typically be your edibles or other things that are non-combustible that do not pose a harm to the person or the general public, and c, if no heat or pressure is used to separate the cannabinoids from the marijuana, a product containing cannabinoids that has been separated from marijuana using ethanol or carbon dioxide. At this point there, I think that's generally it. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you may have regarding...
Just to clarify, I take it you support the phrasing in Senate Bill 936?
I do, yes. And I would recommend that either we add, I believe it's... the fats and oils is what is not in Senate Bill 464 right now. One of the suggested recommendations, as you will see in my testimony that I've submitted, recommends that we add that, or you could simply pull the language from Senate Bill 936, and it's essentially the same thing. It encompasses the types of extracts that medical cannabis patients would be using at home to produce things, as some of the medicines that have been said in the previous hearing, actually.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much, and thanks for bringing this bill.
Thank you.
We have Oscar Nilsson, who's come from over 100 miles, and he'll be joined with Lindsay Reinhardt.
Hey, senators and representatives. Again, my name is Oscar Nilsson. I'm from Astoria, representing Sweet Relief Natural Medicine. To be quite frank, I was slightly unprepared on what this Senate bill was regarding, but I do want to state that through the course of having the medical marijuana dispensary, we have seen a lot of processors and individuals that purchase, trim, and process it themselves. I see this being something that's going to be very difficult to contain. Butane is available everywhere. Solvents are available everywhere. People do enjoy having, kind of like the homebrew industry, being able to produce something themselves and have the control of the process. Again, I apologize that I don't know all the ins and outs of the bill, but I do anticipate that alcohol extraction would probably be considered a solvent, potentially flammable. I'm seeing a possible no on that. That is also something with the Rick Simpson oil, where people need to have access to being able to get cancer treatments, things for nausea and other health issues. So I believe that this is something that should be more of an education approach, giving people an option to know and develop safe ways of being able to process this extract and not throw the whole thing out as a possibility.
Thank you.
Good evening again. I am actually pretty favorable of
please
this.
Please put your name on the record again.
Sorry. My name is Lindsay Reinhardt, and I'm from Happy Valley, Oregon. As far as 464 goes, I'm actually pretty favorable of this. I just had a couple of things I wanted to add to it. The way I read it, I saw that it did not include the water or the vegetable glycerin. I think 936 is better in that it also has the food-grade alcohol. Patients need to be able to make oil at home outside. If you guys have anything to license or permit, I would really love to see that go towards butane, propane, hexane, things where people can actually cause significant damage and not just, you know, things that we need help with. And then also the thing that really concerned me in here was that the rules for the safety would be developed by the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, but it didn't make any mention of people who are currently doing extractions that aren't having safety issues now. People who are doing doing it properly using closed loop systems, people who have the proper permits to handle the chemicals, people who are getting zero residual solvents in their lab testing. Those are people that you guys should be looking to for input on how to do things safely, in my opinion. And so when you guys go to form the rules, I would just think it would be better to include members of the community that already know how to do these things safely and get their input as well, because together I think the policy would be better.
Senator Pisanski.
Yeah, Lindsay, just to let you know, normally when the agencies such as this have these type of tasks, it's not uncommon for them to have a rural advisory committee that will be made up of individuals with those type of expertise. We've seen that in the medical field previously.
Right.
And I think that's what you would see on the medical marijuana side as being implemented through that process.
Okay. I understood about the rules of advisory committee. I just didn't see it ordered in the thing, so I just wanted to make sure that input from the community would be heard.
Thanks.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Thanks for clearing that up, Senator Pisanski. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we will have Todd Delato and Benji Huddington.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, my name is Todd Delato. I live in near Albany, Oregon, in Representative Olson's district. I've been professionally in the cannabis industries for over 21 years. I'm a horticultural scientist, industry consultant, and public policy advisor. I also am a member and former chair of the Advisory Committee on Medical Marijuana, and have served on several legislative and administrative advisory committees for the state. The type of process that we're talking about here, the things that are of concern of danger, is called supercritical fluid extraction. And this is a process that has a wide range of applications in various industries. And it's a process that uses solvents such as carbon dioxide and alkanes and adjusting heat and pressure to achieve a supercritical fluid state, which gives the solvent properties, chemical and physical properties of both gas and liquid, which really improves its efficiency and effectiveness as a solvent. They're commonly used in many industries, including the extraction of essential oils, decaffeinating coffee, petrochemical and pharmaceutical manufacturing, as well as the extraction of hop oil by breweries. It's a reasonably safe manufacturing process when conducted in a proper facility with proper equipment by qualified technicians and using pure solvents. The few explosions and fires that have occurred in Oregon have been a result of inadequate facilities, inadequate equipment, and incompetent people. And this is not characteristic of the majority of medical marijuana patients who are currently doing this safely, unregulated. And it's important to regulate cannabis processing facilities for protecting the health and safety of the public, employees, consumers. But requiring the OHA and OLCC to establish standards for safety, equipment design, emergencies, and lots of other things may be a little redundant, because these standards are already established for all these other industries that I mentioned that use the same manufacturing process. The only difference in this context is they're processing marijuana, which really doesn't add anything to the danger of the process, I don't really see any need to create any new more stringent standards just because it's marijuana, but instead I propose that the OLCC and OHA require that licensed processors who engage in supercritical extraction maintain third-party certification for state enforceable good manufacturing practices that have been established for botanical extractions and the manufacture of herbal medicines. GMPs cover all of the areas of concern that are listed in sections 2 and 4 of this bill. So I would suggest that we go that route to simplify the role of the OLCC and OHA in this rulemaking. In my written materials, I also included a proposed amendment to the definition of extract. I submitted the language for the definition for Senate Bill 936 that Sam Chapman pointed out to Legislative Council through Representative Buckley, and I amended that definition just a little bit. And the purpose of redefining it is to draw a clear line between the types of extraction and solvents that are safe for people to use at home unregulated and those that are more hazardous that would require licensing and all of the special standards. And being that, you know, things like vegetable glycerin, fats, oils are safe and very customary for patients to do at home. Even ethanol when you're not using pressure and high heat as well. So hopefully you find this definition to satisfy that clear line, because doing these types of preparations are very important for patients who need to prepare medicine in the way that's most effective for the treatment of their condition. So by properly regulating the commercial extraction of cannabinoids, we have an opportunity to support the safe and responsible operation and innovation of cannabinoid extraction industry and also promote the availability of safe and effective marijuana products while reducing the activity of unsafe and irresponsible and unregulated production. So I support this bill with the proposed amendments that I made, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Other questions from the committee? Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Madam Co-Chair, sorry. Yes. I've been thinking my hand up fast enough. I'm sorry about that.
Well, actually, I violated my own rule, and I took questions before the second person
I'd
testified.
Be happy to wait.
Okay. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Vanjie Huntington, and I'm sort of surprised by this. I didn't know about this meeting until today. I am a small-time grower. I make oil for my patients and myself. I'm also allergic to 90% of any pain meds that are available for me to use. My doctors have been very good on getting me on medical marijuana, and especially oil. I make a good grade oil from a high CBD strain, which doesn't make somebody buzzy or loopy, but takes away their chronic pain. But we make it in a safe method. We use a water distiller and a steam extraction. One has Everclear that we use, and it leaves the chlorophyll in. The steam extraction uses Everclear, but takes the chlorophyll out. The end result is an oil that has very little toxic waste in it, like a little bit of alcohol, which you boil off at the end of the process. So what you have left is clear oil that you can put in a pen, like a vape pen, and smoke, or we put them in capsules and take them in capsules with coconut oil. The point I'm trying to make is that a lot of small growers, a lot of older people, do this at home now. We don't blow ourselves up. We don't burn our house down. It's the process that people are doing, but if you make the rules so stringent and make it that we can't do it ourselves, where are we going to go? A lot of us can't afford to go buy the oil anyplace, so we make it. You depend upon your grower to make a good quality oil for you as your grower and you as their patient. So I just want you to take in consideration that there are a lot of senior people out there that are using oil extracts now for pain relief, for chronic pain relief. And it's one of the few things that I've found that keeps me going from day to day. I'm up there in years. I look a little bit younger than what I actually am, but I've had 8 surgeries on my hands, and I just had double knee surgery. And I contribute a lot of my recovery to the fact that I was had available to me a good cannabis extracted oil in either pill form or be able to take it in a vape pen. I've never smoked a joint. I've never done a water thing. But I do use the vape pens, and I do use the pills. So please take it in consideration when you think about making the rules, that they're not so strict that the home person is not going to be able to do it.
Could you just tell the committee what Everclear is?
Everclear is a
liquor. 151.
Yeah.
Would that be covered?
90% ethanol.
Madam Co-Chair, we'll go out afterwards and I'll show you what Everclear is.
And it says right
you drink,
there.
You little tiny bits of that.
Not open near an open flame. We used it for years making our own Kahlua.
I'm just trying to
be using it now.
I'm just trying to figure out whether that would be covered under this bill, whether Everclear would be covered under this bill.
Well, it's a salt. It's an alcohol. It's a solvent. But you don't have to use Everclear. You could use rum or vodka or whatever you like.
How about red wine? would this be covered under the bill?
It would be under the. It could be not. Would not be included as an extract, so long as you didn't use heat or pressure to do it as it's currently written. Mr. Dottle.
An Everclear would be a heat product.
But it does use heat. It does use a water distiller. Does produce heat, but it's at a low temperature because if you get up to a certain temperature, my water distiller keeps everything under 180. If you get over that, then you're destroying some of your cannabinoids and stuff. So you want to keep it as low as process as possible. Mm-hmm. But you recover 90% of the alcohol that you use in making this. And it goes right into a water pitcher. There's nothing, I would not suggest lighting up a cigarette by it, but I wouldn't want somebody doing that if they were pouring anything else either. So, but it's just, you know, just think about the lot of the senior people out there that are doing this themselves. And we're taking care of everything.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Buckley, you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Todd, thank you, and thank you for your testimony. Thank you both. Todd, when you talked about the good manufacturing practices, I want to make sure I'm clear on this. Are you suggesting that we actually amend the bill to put into the bill that OLCC will use the good manufacturing practices as the standard for the licensure for handling the what you call the hazardous parts of this process?
Representative Buckley. The good manufacturing practices are one example of a set of standards we can adopt. The World Health Organization has published GMPs for the manufacturing of herbal products. In enforcing the GMP may be difficult at the state level because a lot of it is FDA federally enforced or internationally enforced. So I guess that's something for legislative council to figure out. But GMPs is one example. There are other types of third-party certification for industry standards. GMPs are pretty comprehensive. They cover management, competency of the technicians, record keeping, as well as all the technical aspects.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Senator Pozanski.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Todd, in your testimony, your written testimony, you make reference to allowing for low heat or not high heat for, I guess I'm going to say, for home use. And is that, I mean, that's basically what we're hearing as to for this type of a distilling process where it's not as volatile and it just allows for that process to work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This has been one of the more complicated definitions I've ever had to come up with. And the ethanol, which is Everclear, is 95% ethanol. It's the highest percentage of ethanol that you can get without a license. That has been complicated because you can extract using ethanol safely. You wouldn't want to use a burner, but a hot plate or a stove, as long as there's no vapor coming out. There is proper equipment to use, one of them being a device called a Sauchlet extractor. And as long as it's sealed and used properly, and there's no flame and you have good ventilation, even a fume hood on a regular stove, it can be done safely at home. It's only the alkane, which butane and propane are members of the alkane chemical family. It's only when you have that high of a pressure with such a volatile solvent that I think is really the concern of this committee. And the use of ethanol at home unregulated, people do that a lot with other types of herbs unregulated without any problem. I've never heard of someone, an explosion due to an ethanol extraction at home. But
thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really a question for Ms. Huntington. You described yourself as a patient and a grower.
Yes.
And I guess, and I gather, as a caregiver for others.
Yes.
And you're producing a product that they consume.
That they what?
That they use.
Yes.
Okay. At what point would you consider yourself a processor or a manufacturer?
I would imagine if I was producing a large amount. I know there are people that have machines that do 10, 20 pounds at a time of trim, or what we call duff bud. We are a bunch of senior ladies that our trim, we put it all together. We keep it strain specific so that we know which ones are the high CBD ones. And we probably do maybe out of 2 pounds of trim, we'll get enough oil to last all of us for a whole year. But we make it fresh for each crop that comes in. We make it fresh, so it's always fresh. I don't think it would ever go bad, but we do make it fresh. We probably only process a couple pounds a year. Okay. We leave the bigger stuff to the bigger guys.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the illustration here is excellent, and we're going to have to figure out how not to inhibit people from small batch home processed medicines by scooping them up in the regulatory network of processors or suppliers or manufacturers, and that's going to be artful. That's going to be very difficult to do, because it's not just a matter of scale, it's a matter of whether you're producing for yourself or others. And whether or not there's a commercial aspect to it. So I really appreciate the illustration that you provided, because it's going to make me think really hard about the one thing that is clear from the Measure 91 intent, which is don't inhibit or mess with the medical side. So, that's a principle. But we're going to have to figure out who's a processor, who's a manufacturer, and figure out how to regulate those that we want to regulate, but not interfere with those that are doing something on the scale that you've described. So it's going to be like home brewers, maybe, or home distillers.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to write it, but that's the challenge.
That's what we're hoping for, because the people who are going to be doing this in a big way are going to have the money and the resources to do it safely, I hope, and to do it correctly. The small people, like a lot of us senior citizens, are on a fixed income, and we grow our own. We make our own oil, because we cannot afford, even at medical marijuana, to go into a dispensary and buy, the capsules or the oil. We make salve out of our oil to put on aches and pains and stuff. That works very good. We do it all ourselves. It's for us girls, and we give them to, some of our other senior citizens. But we are not a large producer. But it would be very detrimental to us if we could not do it ourselves and had to rely on going to a dispensary.
Well, but I think it's also fair to say from your testimony, and again, I'm certainly not an expert, as we all know now, since I didn't know what Everclear was, that it also seems clear to me that you're not using the kind of process that blows up people's houses. And if you were, that would probably be something that would...
No, if you go out on YouTube, there is a process called Rick Simpson Oil that shows you using a turkey cooker and everything, and it's just like if you were going to cook a turkey in oil, mm-hmm. it could blow up. And I did, one of my clients asked me to make this oil, and she told me what she'd been doing, and I was absolutely appalled. I said, oh, my God, you're going to kill yourself. And I did a little research and found that you can get the same results using a water distiller, actually a better result, and we started doing that. But there are people who would think that all they have to do is go out in their driveway, you know, fill it up, dump the stuff in, torch it off, and walk away with something that's good. Very, very dangerous, no matter what you use.
And that's really what we're trying to get at, is the dangerous things that mm-hmm. that threaten people's lives.
What could go wrong?
Other questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'd just like to thank Ms. Huntington. I've certainly got a new slant on the golden years now.
That was good.
Senator Beyer, did you have a question?
No.
Okay. All right. Thank you. This has been a very educational panel. Okay, our last panel will be Robert Omig and Mike Rockland.
Good evening, Madam Chairwoman. I'm Robert Omay. I'm a resident of Salem, Oregon, and this bill, quite frankly, it's very clear the purpose is to bring safety to the people here in Oregon. In the testimony and the example that was given by Fox News, each and every incident where there was an explosion involved butane. These are kids that have no more sense than, they don't have the sense they should. However, like Ms. Huntington, there are literally thousands of people out there. There is a letter from one of the fibromyalgia organizations that have over 300 people that make Rick Simpson oil. They do it at home. They do it to treat their diseases. It's a very specific process. Like Ms. Huntington mentioned, it's done with a still and ethanol alcohol, and very safe. I think it's the medicine of last recourse for people with everything from Alzheimer's to multiple cirrhosis, which my wife suffers from. So as long as we have an exemption similar to the water and glycerin and ethanol alcohol, I think all of the people that are part of the medical program will be able to continue to make their medicine in the way they're accustomed to. It will not interfere in any way, shape, or form with the OLCC and those that wish to make butane products. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions?
We'll wait until we hear the next testimony.
Excuse me.
Mr. Rockland.
Okay, thank you, Senator Burdick, co-chairs, and 91 panel. I'm Mike Rockland. I'm a founding partner of MJ Enterprises, LLC. I do advising for small business as well as in the medical marijuana industry. I'm a patient advocate. I've been a registered nurse, cannabis nurse, for many years, and recently joined the Cannabis Nurses of America to reinforce that position, because what I see in 464 is kind of a bill on household use, if I'm reading it right, to certify people that are going to do extractions for household use. Is that what I'm reading this? Because if it is, I think that's no. So that's what I was trying to clarify. So if the bill is for anybody processing, including medical patients or for medical marijuana and or retail together, is that what I'm reading that as? OHA and OLCC.
Yes, please respond, Senator Pazanski.
This is, as the testimony you heard from Mr. Chapman was basically trying to close the loophole. Measure 91 actually calls out that this is not supposed to, these type of processes are not supposed to be done at home. Under Measure 91, but under the medical warning to take care of the issues that we've heard about on the Tains, the more high volatile. And when the bill was drafted, we did not have the definition that's now in Senate Bill 936, as well as House Bill 3400. And it would be the sponsor of the bill and for the individual that was that we put it in for. We both have testified or stated that we'd like to have that definition. We'll give much more clarity and be much more to what Mr. Delato has suggested that we do.
Okay, so to me, the way it got a little bit confusing, my perception was the medical side and the retail side kind of coming together under their respective regulatory organizations such as OHA and OLCC. But currently, there's no prohibition to do anything with medical as far as extractions. This kind of clarifies it. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes.
Okay. So my concern, again, would be medical patient safety and medical efficacy. Mm-hmm. Okay. So for people that need, typically medical patients need higher doses. They need higher possessions just because of the nature of their illnesses, severe illnesses. That's what this is about. For the retail side, I'm hearing a lot of good stuff come with standards and other kinds of things, and this included meaning that let's get a process for anybody processing something with retail. My concern about bringing it together with medical this time is it's just confusing for dispensaries, for the patients. I mean, as it is, I've heard a lot of testimony about education or lack of thereof, so it's confusing to people. So it might be easier to kind of sort this out and then pull it together, if you know what I mean. In other words, if we're talking about extractions, that's already being done on the medical side. Medical dispensaries have a method to do that. The safety aspects is what I'm hearing is really embedded in here. I haven't seen or heard of anything firsthand that's been, except for illegal, or we heard one case today mentioned about, and again, it's hearsay to me, but again, about people actually having experienced in the process of what they're normally doing for workplaces, whether it's retail or medical, having an issue with an injury. I don't know. I don't have that data. And so news reports have come out in the newspapers. You know, and how much of that data, I would encourage the committee to look at ways of rounding that data up, making sure it's accurate before new regulations come on to impose on medical, because medical basically is more for patient safety and using for medical purposes marijuana than it is for retail side. You may have some overflow from the retail side, but it sounds to me like most of the retail, I'm calling it retail, but adult use marijuana would be best to get some of those standards straight and then pull it over to the medical side. Because of the small business, a lot of small business are in medical marijuana and caregiving. So that emphasis would lessen the cost impact immediately, because I think what's going to happen is anybody looking at regulations all the time, especially for small business, which a lot of medical are going to get concerned, how's this going to impact me? And I don't see the impact here, but I do have some concerns about where's the funding going to come from. When I see the word certification, who's going to do the training, the education, all that. That's why I get a little concerned about small business, about entry-level people having to deal with something that may be more appropriate for a large scale. And the end result is I don't see a lot of the illegal activities getting thwarted by this. If these are indeed some of the illegal things that are happening, versus if you're going to certify and train somebody, does that still help us from reducing these fires or explosions that are reported? I don't know. I think it's a lot of burden that, from what I've seen in the news, a lot of it has to do with either operations that aren't legitimate or are working in the garage that maybe are going to come to fruition better with the retail side rules.
Other questions? Are you more questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate bill?
Hand up.
Oh, okay. Two hands up. Come on up. Please give your name for the record.
My name is Jennifer Valley. I'm from Happy Valley, Oregon. I'm with Stony Girl Gardens. I was diagnosed with the most advanced case of thyroid cancer ever seen in a living patient when I was 25 years old. And when I joined the medical marijuana program in 1999, I immediately saw a huge difference in my healthcare costs. I went from 25 to 35 pills a day down to 2. Instead of 10 ER visits a year, I haven't been in the last 15 years, and instead of spending 50 hours a year seeing my doctor, I really only saw him last year to renew my medical marijuana card.
Excuse me, if I could just break in for a second. We're running a little short on time.
Okay.
So it'd be most productive if you could focus on the bill and give us some guidance there.
I wasn't able to cure my cancer until I tried cannabis extract oil. I only made it myself because what I found on the commercial, what was available commercially, I was very uncomfortable with the solvents they were using, including propane and butane and naphtha. So what I do is food grade. Because I was able to cure my cancer after 17 years, I'm the cannabis consultant of record to Oregon Health Sciences Palliative Care Unit head, and I also get referrals from Mayo Clinic about 4 times a week. So I see patients from all across the country. They come here, they get their cannabis oil, they go home, use their medicine there. Generally speaking, I don't see them again. One 90-gram jar either cures their cancer.
Could you address your comments to the bill?
I'm primarily concerned. I think that it's very important that we have commercial licensure, that folks meet some standards, but I also know that I was not able to cure my cancer until I made this oil myself at home, and I would still like medical patients to be able to do that. The process does include heat and pressure. But if you have proper training and do it in a well-ventilated area and, you know what you're doing, you're not going to have a problem. It's just, as we've seen, user error is where we're having a problem. And, again, I'm very uncomfortable with the propane and butane extractions.
So I'm hearing you say you would not object to banning the use of tanes in a home
right.
setting.
Okay.
Thank you. That's
Thank
helpful.
You so much.
Welcome.
Hi, my name is Corey Vauden. I'm with Crash Gardens. Gresham, out of Gresham.
Corey, could you spell your last name?
V as in Victor, O, D as in dog, D as in dog, E, N.
Thank you.
I'm an extractor. Our main form of extraction is butane. All of the research and studies that we've done and personally have taken to the lab and have obtained the information is showing that it's really beneficial to be able to do it. It's a low temp extract. It's the most efficient and effective way to remove the trichome from the material to get it into a form that's either edible or smokable for the medical person.
And do you do this processing in your home?
No. It's on the property, but it's not in my house.
Okay. So are you opposed to the bill, or?
I would say that I'm opposed to the bill, but I really believe that it needs to be regulated. I would say education before regulation should happen.
Thank you. Senator Pozanski.
Could you tell us what type of process or equipment you are using?
It sounds like the closed loop system.
Okay. And that's
On some occasions, we do open loop extractions for small batches.
But normally for your commercial side, you're doing a closed-loop system?
Yes.
Okay.
But as far as you have a garden that produces so much flower, and if you only get one plant, you can't put all of it into one extraction machine. So you have to use an open-loop system in order to produce a small amount of medicine, which is typically going to happen for the home consumer.
Good. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that completes our testimony on Senate Bill 464. So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 464. And committee, I announced at the beginning that we would have a kind of a rolling work session on our OLCC technical bill, Senate Bill 844. So at this time, Representative Leininger has been very helpful in putting together a list of issues that she wanted the committee to consider. And we also have Tom Burns, and I don't see Steve Marks here, but he's invited if he's here to come up and kind of give us an update on what has happened since our last hearing and reactions to our last hearing. So Adam, why don't you, the committee has, did you want to put in some comments?
Yeah, may I just preface this? So what we're about to talk about here is our effort to summarize the points that were raised in the last hearing and kind of capture the open questions or the requests for changes so we'd have an inventory of that. And to be candid, Adam did most of this. But thank you for your willingness to sit with me.
Well, he was very gracious and giving
all
the credit
to you.
He was
very quiet. Thank you, Adam.
It might actually make more sense to start off with Mr. Burns because you had some information that you wanted to bring us, and then we could maybe go through the memo after that. Or
co-chairs and members, for the record, Tom Burns, Director of Marijuana Program for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. There were a number of issues that we discussed last Monday. We are still working to come up with answers for those issues. Some of them are on this list. Some of them are others that Adam shared with us. And we anticipate having answers to all of your questions by Monday. I apologize, but there's just four of us working in this group, and 48 hours isn't quite enough to give you a good, thorough response. So at this point, we have nothing new to add to the conversation from Monday.
Okay, well, good. We will we will proceed with this. And also, I should alert the committee that we need to hear from the attorney for the OLCC, who is going to be looking over these issues in depth. And she will be available, as I understand it, after March 30th.
Right.
And you know, she'll need to get back to speed after being in the wilderness somewhere for spring break.
Back to weed management.
Okay. So, Adam, why don't you start us off? If you just stay there, Tom, to comment on any of these things.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, what you have in front of you is, as Representative Leininger alluded to, is an attempt to recap the meeting on March 23rd. The memo is broken down into a few parts. One, deletion from the Dash 1 amendment and potential movement to the policy bill. In that includes the requirement for bonds in sections 13 and 14, starting on page 13 of the Dash 1s. There seems to be a few questions relating to bonding, specifically whether or not if the bond would be available for businesses. The second would be the size of the bond required. The third, regarding if the bond is intended to cover any unpaid taxes, whether the language should reflect the class of the license intended to pay the tax rather than all classes of license. I don't know if Mr. Burns would like to comment on that, or if you'd like me to continue. But
I think that it would be most helpful as we go item by item to check in with Mr. Burns on how many of these you see as really crucial to have in the bill to allow your rulemaking to go forward.
Sure.
If there, you know, sometimes it's kind of a close call as to what goes in this immediate bill and what's saved later for further debate in the policy bill. So we really want to get your opinions on that.
So, co-chairs and members, the bonding, both the bond for the tax No, let me start that over again. The bonding issue, which we asked for, is authority to impose a bond on the person who is obligated to pay the tax to make sure that they can't walk on us. You know, they sell $100,000 worth of product in the stream and disappear the next day. We would have a bond to go back and collect the tax against them. As with the insurance discussion, both of those are major issues of concern that both you identified and we are aware of about whether it's even possible to get those bonds. And what we would like is, as we said, is the authority to do this. It's not a mandatory that we do this, and the language in the bill is a little stronger than we were looking for. We were just looking for the authority to do this so that we could put in rule and say to the bonding and insurance world, this is what we're looking for, and give them six to whatever, however months left until we have to start accepting applications to understand what we're looking for and see what the market does. We are currently researching the question about what kind of insurance and bonding there is out there, and we'll be able to get back to you on Monday with that, but we don't have an answer for that today.
So basically what you're asking for is to kind of tone down the bill but still give you the authority to look into it.
And to impose it by rule if in fact it works, that there is enough ability for the businesses to buy the bond and insurance.
Right, and this would apply to your comments would apply to both the first two bullets, the tax one and the one for insurance.
Correct.
Okay. Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, okay, so Tom, just to clarify, you're just using the description of Lloyd's of London as a potential insurance agent.
Yeah, co-chairs and representatives, right. We know for a fact that Lloyd's of London is insuring many of the businesses in the state today. The problem is Lloyd's, as you know, is the insurance of last resort. And so the rates that we are aware of are much higher than rates that we are aware other businesses are getting. And so we're trying to figure out, are there other businesses that we're just not aware of in the marketplace right now?
Okay, just follow up with that. Have you had a chance to talk with any of the folks out here that have insurance right now or thought about it, what they're seeking?
On the insurance question, I have had conversations with medical dispensary owners who are up and functioning as business about what kind of insurance they have, both for their employees and for their personal liability. And most of them are, in fact, going to Lloyd's to get their insurance.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Senator Beyer.
So to be clear then, Tom, this draft says delete those items. You don't want them deleted. You might want them stated as a may rather than a shall.
Co-chairs and Senator Barr, yes. It was always our desire to have the authority, not to be mandated that it in fact be the trigger be pulled, for lack of a better example.
So we don't want to.
What we want to do is, particularly on the insurance, I mean on the tax side, is again, we really want to be able to do this, but if there's no market, there's no way we can make this work.
So what I'm trying to get a sense from the committee, this draft says delete it, but does everyone feel comfortable leaving it in but making it permissive? But changing the shall to may. Okay, we'll proceed accordingly.
And I'm sorry, co-chair, Senator Burdick, and on the the bond applying only to the payer of the tax, not to the other three licenses.
Got it. Okay. That's a key thing.
Excellent. The next item, other than insurance, which we've already covered, peace officer authority, there seems to be some questions regarding the legislative intent for OLCC to regulate the home grow sections of Measure 91. I don't know if we would like to keep that and delete from the dash ones and move to the policy bill or further amend that section.
Senator Cruz.
Just a thought. I mean, going in to inspect a marijuana grow with things that could be going on in the periphery, I think would be slightly different than going in to look at a liquor store. I mean, is there a safety issue? I mean, do you have DPSST trained folks that can do the enforcement? Because we're looking at two parallel worlds here. Right. And I almost think we'd want to have sworn officers if we're going to, or at least available if we're going to do the inspections.
Co-chairs and Senator Cruz, clearly the agency would like a peace officer status. And the issue is whether the language that was in the dash ones, which says, and any other marijuana statute, whether we should be enforcing that. At least that was the conversation you had. We don't have a position on that, but that was a conversation that occurred around the table, was that clause that expanded it to allow us to enforce any other marijuana statute above and beyond the Measure 91 statutes.
Okay.
We clearly want peace officer status.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
Senator Pruzanski.
Yeah, I want some clarification because my understanding is OLCC said last on Monday, you're here to basically regulate the Measure 91 as it pertains to retail type of operations and all the parts that will lead up to the actual retail sale. What I want to make certain is that you're not asking for authority to go in and check to see about someone's home grow. Inspecting a homegrown setting, correct?
Co-chairs and Senator Pruzanski, that is correct. But the language that is in the draft one appears to allow us to do that.
I understand that.
It's
so
not
that's
our
what
intention
we,
to do that.
That's what we need to clarify, because what we have is if someone thinks that there's an illegal grow operation going on, that is for law enforcement to deal with. And to be putting OLCC people on the premise of knocking on someone's door and saying, hey, we understand you got a home grow here, we want to look at it, is going to be, let's say, not real comfortable.
Well, the way I heard the testimony was that they wanted to have the ability that if they are doing their job under Measure 91 and they see something in the course of that, which is different than knocking on somebody's door, that they want to, they don't want to have to leave and get a law enforcement officer. They want to be able to deal with that situation.
Yeah, Madam Co-Chair, I don't think there's a problem with that, them being able to stay there and that, but the premise of why they're there is not that they're looking at a homegrown. They're going there because they know it's a licensed facility for whatever they're supposed to be doing at that facility. And once they get there and they find that they're outside of compliance with their license or something else is going on, that's what they're looking at dealing with.
Right. And so that was a sense I got. Did others get that same sense that that's what they were talking about, not making forays into home grows.
Not house calls.
Yeah, not house calls.
It was my understanding, Madam Chair, that their intent was to move forward into it from a civil perspective.
Right.
And then and if the scope changed where they could act on from a criminal perspective, then so be it with that authority.
Correct. Yeah. You said it better than I did. What he said. So is that the sense of the committee? Or should we? Representative Flanagan.
Thank you. I definitely agree with what Representative Olson just said, but do we need to make it more clear or somehow narrow the language as currently written so that there's no suggestion that, you know, if you're annoyed by your neighbor next door and you think maybe they have five plants instead of four plants, you can call up, you know, Tom Burns' office and get the OLCC to come show up at their house. I mean, I definitely agree that we like the idea of civil enforcement instead of criminal, and that we intend for OLCC peace officers to be able to go and inspect those. But do we need to cabinet a bit?
You know, I don't think so, because OLCC does not regulate home grows.
Right.
The OLCC only regulates the
licensed
premises. Mm-hmm. So I think this is intended to just allow them, if they see, as Representative Olson said, if they see some criminal activity, to be able to respond to that in their license premise capacity. Is that how others understood it? Senator Beyer.
Well, I guess I agree with that, but I wonder, sort of like someone doing not home brewing but distilling and getting, you could have some that you're supposed to be licensed but you're choosing not to, and maybe you should. Who's going to do that? That seems to be, licensing is one of the things on the alcohol side that they do. Some they have instances where they're going in and saying, you're not supposed to be doing that without a license.
But
I think you could have a crossover with that, which I think is different than just, I'm the home grow kind of a thing.
Well, but I think also that that really is the job of law enforcement. If someone is not licensed and they're doing something illegal, that really is the job of law enforcement. That's not the job.
It crosses over in the alcohol enforcement.
Does it? Senator Fasansky.
Of course, Tom's not going to be able to answer the question as it pertains to alcohol and the type of the enforcement they do. But if the call came in, let's say on the neighbor situation, he's going to say, well, we don't license them, and we're not going to, we can't go in and check that out. Report it to your local police.
Correct.
It would seem to me that when you have an illegal activity going on that is not a license.
Following up as to my home brewing, I would never expect OLCC is going to come knock on my door to see about how much home brewing I've done.
Not yet.
Not yet.
We will now.
After this hearing.
I'm calling the missus right now.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to, because Tom, you were saying you want sworn officers. You want authority, but do you want sworn officers?
Co-chairs and Senator Cruz, it's my understanding that we do not currently have sworn officers on the alcohol side, but we do have peace officer status, which allow, as I understand it, and this is way beyond me, but as I understand it, in the alcohol, it allows them to issue a legal citation against somebody who is publicly drunk, for example. But we do not have police powers.
We're not asking for police powers.
We're asking for the same authority we have on the alcohol side to mirror on the marijuana side.
They have the ability to write someone a citation and send them into court for like a minor in possession on alcohol. Or they would have the same thing if they were at a licensed premises and they saw someone being served alcohol that appeared to be under 21 and it wasn't apparent, or even in the open public area, a parent can't do that there. So, I mean, they do have those type of authorities.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Byers and I, we were involved in that OLC task force last year, and to listen to some of this. They do not have the authority to arrest. They can issue citations. But I don't believe they can have the authority to arrest.
Co-chairs and Senator Representative Olson, I apologize. I don't know the answer. But it is my understanding that we want the same authority on alcohol as there currently is on... I mean, we want the same authority on marijuana as there currently is on alcohol. And you had expressed concerns about whether the language at the bottom of page 31, lines 29 through 30, was so broad as to allow us to work outside of the provisions of Measure 91. And that's what I heard, and that's what I circled based on the conversation.
Madam Chair, I think what Tom is saying is, and I think what we're agreeing with, is we want OLCC to have the same authority for marijuana as they do with that, and we should just leave it up to LC and staff to figure that out. Parallel that.
That's right.
How about if we put this in the parking lot till we get our lawyer back in town and try to give some direction on what we're after?
And Co-Chair Senator Burdick, that is responding to this very issue is on our list that we will deliver to you on Monday.
That's wonderful. Okay. Adam, next one.
The final one on deleting from the -1 amendments. As a request from OLCC, OLCC currently in the -1 amendments has the ability to seize marijuana product to pay for delinquent taxes. My understanding was OLCC did not want this in the -1 amendments.
That is correct.
Is that correct?
Okay. Co-chairs, yes, that is correct. We do not want that authority.
Okay, anybody want to overrule OLCC on this? All right, it's out.
The next section relates to additions to the -1 amendments. There was a question about whether or not we wanted to add back in the definition of person back into Section 1, starting on page 4, line 29.
Okay, now what would that do?
The definition of person was taken out of the -1 amendments, though it was in the original Measure 91. The point was raised by Jeff Sugarman of the Oregon Cannabis PAC. It might have just been a legislative council drafting issue.
Co-chairs, I talked to Mark Mayer about why this came out, and as again, I don't want to speak for him, but what little bit I understood of what he said was it was because there is an overarching statute already in place on the definition of what a person is, and that these words were slightly different than that overarching statute that currently governs all Oregon statutes. And so there's no reason to include a different definition on the marijuana statute and create person defined differently for marijuana than they would for any other transaction or business in the state.
Yeah. Uniformity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Delete that.
So we will leave that out. The second addition to the potential addition to the Dash 1 amendments, the potential addition of marijuana products that's found in HB 2041-1 presented by the Oregon Infused Topicals Association. That definition is a marijuana product means a food or potable liquid or any other product intended for oral consumption into which marijuana or a marijuana extract has been incorporated, a lotion, cream, gel, balm, oil, ointment, or any other product meant to be applied to the surface of a person's body, including skin and hair, into which marijuana extract has been incorporated, and the products containing cannabinoids other than those products described in the subparagraphs above this paragraph and other than marijuana extracts.
Okay, and this came at the request of the infused product people, right?
Yes.
Did you have a...
Yeah, co-chairs and members. The provisions of Measure 91 do not reference the topical side of the marijuana business. It is very much used on the medical side. I'm assuming that people will want to use it on the recreational side. I think the idea of adding some sort of definition is correct. But this gets into, and I apologize, I have not read all this, but the whole question that we've raised of the conversation around extract and concentrate and medical and marijuana product, and we are currently working through that, and we'll come back to you with some language that addresses the concerns that was brought up by the Infused Topical Coalition, and as well as our concerns about the definition of the word extract and concentrate and how that works with the rest of Measure 91.
Okay. And is that something that you had planned for Monday, or
yes,
do you need a little more time?
Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you. All right.
The next session relates to changes to the Dash 1 amendments. There was a request for MIRA OLCC age verification language as it relates to alcohol. There was some questions relating to age scanner information specifically raised by Kimberly McCullough of the ACLU related to every time a driver's license or identification is scanned, there's a potential for data leakage there by mirroring statutory language, not requiring every person that comes into a retail establishment to have their ID scanned might satisfy ACLU, as well as, I believe, my understanding was the OLCC.
So basically just question looking at those that you don't know.
Co-chairs and members, what the OLCC would like is to be able to impose identification verification systems on those businesses who are having trouble. That's the way we do it on the alcohol side. And we believe that we have met the terms of the provisions that the ACLU raised for our alcohol side. I also know that you asked a number of questions about whether data is stored, whether data is pinged, whether the swipe is pinged against some database, and that is also something that we intend to bring back to you on Monday.
Okay, but basically the intent, I think, that I heard was to try to mirror the process for alcohol in every way we could.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Good. Okay, we'll hear from you on Monday on that.
The second issue is closely related to the first, mirroring OLCC language as it relates to minors in liquor stores. There were some questions regarding who would be allowed in a retail marijuana establishment. It was suggested that that might be addressed by mirroring OLCC standards for minors in liquor stores.
Yeah.
So, co-chairs and members, it's actually our thought that we would be slightly stronger on the marijuana side than we would on the liquor stores. That we would instead require by rule that identification be presented in order to even enter the store. That way we would be assured that there is never a minor inside that store, and we can say clearly to the federal government or the Cole memos, no minor can access the store. That may be stronger than you want to be, but that was what our initial request was.
Question.
Senator Krasanski.
So some of the documentation we got today actually shows a liquor store with appears to be a father with his daughter who may be 3-4 years of age in his arms. And so, I mean, I just want to make certain if that's what we're saying, is that potentially an infant would not be allowed to be brought into the store?
Co-chairs and Senator Krasanski, that is in fact what we had asked for in the request we put forward.
Can I follow up with that? What are you doing right now in that environment with Senator Krasanski just asked for alcohol?
In a liquor store.
Co-chairs and Representative Olson, on the alcohol side, we do not prohibit minors from entering the store. We prohibit them from purchasing, but not from entering the store. We do have bars that are where alcohol is consumed, where we do in fact prohibit minors from being on the premises.
So what you're asking for is similar requirements that you now have for bars.
Just to convolute the thing further, there are certainly establishments that have food service that allow minors for a portion of the open hours, and they're excluded after a certain time. So there's all three models. Exclusion, complete open access, and then modified access.
So based on what we've been talking about, we should mirror what we do with alcohol premises that are similar to what the retail outlets are going to be. And my perspective is that an outlet's going to be just like going into a liquor store where you cannot consume alcohol on the premises. And so, and we know that you cannot consume marijuana on the premises of the outlets. So it seems to me that should be mirror that. Now, if you want to somehow have a bright line and say a certain age and older, because you don't want the teens to be in there, you could do something like that. If this committee thought we wanted to do something like that, but it seems like we're
accompanied by an,
they couldn't come in on their own anyway.
The problem I see is I would really like to, if Shannon's able to communicate with somebody from the U.S. Attorney's office to find out what
the Cole memorandum.
Yeah,
and also maybe Colorado and Washington State to see how that's being handled in those two states.
Cole impacts the important thing on that, probably.
Right.
We'll get back to you on Monday.
Appreciate that. Okay. Next, Adam.
The final potential change to the -1 amendments, amend sections 11 and 12 to include an option for growers to package material in certain instances. The idea behind this was some growers may be selling directly to retail stores. Instead of requiring them to get an additional license to package that material, they would be able to sell into retail outlets.
Co-chairs and members, we identified was that we did not want to have to force a grower, producer, to get a license if all they were doing was to get a processor license if all they were doing was packaging marijuana in bulk to send it down the line. What Mr. Sugarman is proposing here is that there are some growers who have a one-on-one relationship with a retail or maybe with multiple retail outlets. They want to put their product in maybe 1 ounce or 1/8 ounce packaging with the grower's label on it and sell that directly to a retail outlet. We don't care one way or the other on that.
Madam Chair, co-chair, when we talked about this also, it seemed to me that you could actually have the grower selling bulk to the retail outlet, and then the retail outlet would be the one that would break it down into the smaller things, into their packaging.
Brown.
So
they can get their labels and everything.
So I don't think it's necessary the grower breaking it down for the retailer. It's the retailer, and does the retailer have to have a processing license to actually break?
Right, right. And co-chairs and Senator Brzezinski, we also asked for that side so that a retail outlet that wants to package product inside their retail outlet, not for sale to somebody else, but in, you know, they receive a pound of marijuana and they want to put it in 16 one-ounce packages, they could do that and not have to have a processor license.
It's cleaner that way, I think.
And people are comfortable.
Is where we're landing that we'd all be fairly comfortable with both of those scenarios not requiring the extra processing license?
Right. Yeah.
Makes sense to me. Yeah.
I'm good.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just point out one of the conversations that we've been having in the land use breakout group is how to treat growers when they are, especially all growers actually, but especially the outdoor growers who will harvest their crop, bring it to a shed essentially or a facility on their property and do what we're calling primary processing on site, which is some sort of curing or drying. Mm-hmm. And that's a typical agricultural use that other crops are used to. Other farmers are used to processing some of their crops in that same fashion. So this decision that we're making here, I think, will dovetail with that aspect of our decision-making process.
I could rent my baler for that.
In Southern Oregon, you probably could. Okay.
That's 100 pounds.
Well, to be continued on this, I think, with the land use work group. Okay. Now, next category is open questions.
Yes. Adam? There seem to be some questions regarding Section 91, the section allowing OLCC to make rules for an additional year above and beyond that, which they have to make rules for other things. Excuse me, additional rules for processors. It seemed like the committee was moving around between a few different options. One, stick with what was in the Dash 1 amendments, giving them that extra year. Two, not moving that yardstick and making sure that OLCC needed to create processor rules on January 4th, 2016, as they must do for all others. Give OLCC some time limit in between those two, or potentially move it completely over into the policy bill to extend the discussion.
Well, didn't I also hear the option of distinguishing between extracts and edibles, that maybe extracts could stay on the regular schedule and edibles might need a little more time?
Yeah. Co-chairs and members, this was our request for an edible extension only. And Representative, I believe it was Buckley, asked us to come back and detail our concerns about why we didn't think we would be ready by January 1 of 16. To allow edible licenses to be issued. Okay. And we will have that again, I apologize, but on Monday.
Okay, terrific. All right.
The next issue was raised whether or not the committee would like an addition regarding criminal forfeiture of marijuana and marijuana products. Mm-hmm. If so, what does that look like?
Madam Chair, that was an issue that I had raised, and I think the Oregon Liquor Control Commission has a difficulty with possessing marijuana. So if there was a criminal forfeiture consideration, it would land likely with the Department of Justice or the state police.
That's right. Well, or follow-up. I mean, it could even be city or county agency as well.
It has to be some other municipality jurisdiction, because the Cole Memorandum would prevent OLCC from possessing. It's not the Cole Memorandum. It's
just the feds.
The measure, the way it was originally written.
Okay.
Co-chairs and Senator Brzezinski and Senator Farrioli, we asked for ability. Currently, Measure 91 does not allow us or any other state agency to possess any marijuana, period. we've asked the state agencies, including ourselves and the Department of Agriculture and the Department of OHA and potentially the state police, be able to possess small amounts of marijuana. We, for example, are out on an operation. We are inspecting Senator Burdick's facility. We discovered that she has 5 pounds of extra product on there. We would like the ability to remove that 5 pounds of extra product and turn it over to local law enforcement for keeping. But for a while, we will have that in our possession. Or we go in with a minor sting decoy, and we want a byproduct from Mr. Crawford's, Mr. Crawford's outlet, and we need to do a minor sting. We need to physically possess that marijuana for a while we do the minor sting. So that's what we were looking for. The forfeiture issue would place us in the business of having product and then trying to sell that product. And we're very worried about what that might do to our alcohol side of the business, because we are governed on that side by the federal government about what we have to do around alcohol. And we're a little nervous if we start trying to sell marijuana, which is a federally illegal substance, while we're selling a whole lot of alcohol.
Senator Brzezinski.
All right. First of all, on page 9 of the amendments is section 3. There it sets out what OLC may purchase, possess, seize, or dispose of marijuana items. So I was going to ask about the sting operation. That's where I figured the purchase comes in as well, because you don't want to go out and be just purchasing. But I forget, I've got a number of little markers here, but there's another place where if the agency goes in and has to foreclose or take over a facility, there is a language in here that says that you can, in fact, sell to other licensed facilities. So.
Right.
I mean, so there is an opportunity. I mean, not an opportunity. There is provisions in here that says that OLCC would have the authority to sell, but they're limited to who they sell to, which are other licensed facilities, once they got this extra product.
Senator Burr, co-chairs and Senator Brzezinski, what we envision there is we have a business that, for whatever reason, has gone bankrupt, gone out of business, that we would have the ability to unwind that business by calling what a bank essentially does, somebody else to come in and say, do you want to take over this business and buy it from the bankrupt or whatever. We would not actually be in the process of possessing, well, probably technically would, but we don't want to be able to possess the product and then hold it and say, we'll have an auction for whoever wants to come up for it. That's not our intent.
That might not be a bad idea, given our budget problems.
Get you a green visor, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, this isn't quite getting at the issue that I wanted to have discussed, which was, if the underlying principle here is to get rid of the bootlegging and the illicit industry, there undoubtedly are going to be some growers that are currently involved in that process that have no intention of becoming legitimate. The lucrative nature of their export business is so great that they simply will not want to become regulated, share in the cost and pay taxes and go to licensure. And at some point in time, unless there's an option for enforcement that results in seizure and interdiction, you're not going to get rid of those folks, and you're not going to push them back into the, there's no deterrent, you're not going to push them back into the legal side. And what that means to me is you're going to incur a lot of costs with no opportunity for recovery. Unless there's a way to seize cash, vehicles, property involved assets in this criminal enterprise.
No, but that's law enforcement.
It is.
Not OLCC.
It is. But you've got to have some mechanism to put this stuff back into the legitimate market. So it may not be OLCC, but there needs to be a mechanism.
Yeah. Something like this would definitely belong in the policy bill as opposed to the technical bill, I think.
I'd say it already exists.
I was going to ask Tom a question, but I disagree with that. You know, what law enforcement does now when they get illegal drugs is they destroy them, and I think that would be the, if these are illegal, they're not part of the legitimate system, they get destroyed. The same, it's, you know, we aren't in this to make a boatload of money. We're in this to have a legitimate business operate as a legitimate business. And so I would suggest that, which brings me to the point I was going to ask Tom.
if there is a sting operation, I would assume, and you have this, you can't do anything with, the appropriate thing would be to turn it over to law enforcement. Wouldn't you agree?
Right. Co-chair,
Madam Chair, as far as I'm concerned, law enforcement deals with the illegal activities the way they deal with them now.
Okay. Okay, Madam Chair.
Let me make this point one more time. The reason law enforcement destroys the crop now is that it's illegal and illicit. The point I guess I'm trying to make is in order to have a credible deterrent to those that are going to continue, the way to deter with credibility is to go after the assets and take the money out of it and have a credible deterrent.
Yeah,
I think the reason the stuff's burnt now is because there's no legitimate outlet for it. But there will be after July 1st. That's my point.
Just going back to revisit that a little bit, the reason it's burned now is because the aforementioned, but yet if you're confiscating marijuana from people who are operating outside the law anyway, it wouldn't meet standard that hopefully the marijuana of our new program would. So you'd probably want to burn it for that reason.
I think that's an assumption. Wouldn't you need a test before you'd know?
Yeah. Okay.
So, Madam Chair, really quick.
Yes.
Tom, what was your threshold? Are you saying five pounds is what you're kind of toying with right now for seizing?
We don't have co-chairs and Representative Olson, we don't have a threshold.
Okay.
What we want to do is when we see, you know, we go into a grow and they say they have 100 plants, there's 150 plants, we're going to call law enforcement, but we're going to work with law enforcement to pull the extra 50 plants. Or we go into a dispensary, a retail store that has 10 pounds of product that they don't have on the seed-to-sale system that shouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. We want to call law enforcement and confiscate that process. Whether we physically hold it for the 20 minutes for law enforcement to show up or whether we walk out the door with it, it's going to ultimately end up in law enforcement's hands because they're the ones that are going to have to use that as evidence in court. Selling it.
Thank you.
We can't, Madam Chair. We can't sell it, and here's the main reason why. We are creating a legitimate business operation in the state of Oregon. If we're going to confiscate the illegal activities and go into competition with the business we've created, we're doing absolutely the wrong thing.
But you can seize assets.
Assets are different.
That's the whole right.
Okay.
All right, well, we're going to defer the other open questions for next Monday. This has been a useful discussion. Senator Kudansky.
Madam Chair, I went through the amendments. I have a number of questions. I'm wondering if you and the co-chair want me to work with Adam and Tom so they can be on the table.
Absolutely. I appreciate it very much. Okay, that completes our business for tonight. We will take up this bill again on Monday. And do we have other plans for Monday?
We are also looking at your bill.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we will also have the hearing. We are adjourned. We also have the hearing. We are adjourned.